This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
I get to say this every year about this time, and it's still true. You meet the most interesting people when you do a public radio show about knowledge. Today and next week on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look back at a few of my favorite conversations from this past year with people who are a whole lot smarter than me.
When the internet was developed, it was never imagined that computers would have such power.
First, we'll hear from Dr. Phyllis Schneck, the Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Then we'll go back and hear my chat with Jeff Newberry, the poet in residence at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Georgia.
When I was young, I thought poetry had to be about gods or goddesses.
Finally, we'll spend an academic minute talking to the animals. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Cybersecurity may be a fairly new field, but it's been around long enough to have its own government subdepartment. Dr. Phyllis Schneck is Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Back in June, we sat down to talk about cybersecurity, and I asked her if someone fell asleep 20 years ago and just woke up, how would she define cybersecurity to this heavily bearded person?
Protecting the communications among all of our different ways of life, from electricity to water to banking to our cell phones. Everything has a computer in it. Everything is connected. We have to make sure that it's safe.
You have been at this from both the private sector and the public sector now. What are the differences between those two approaches, and is one better than the other?
The private sector is focused on building and innovating great products and services. To do that, they need money. So they have to make money, so they constantly follow a bottom line. It's a classic business model. The government is focused on securing enough money to be able to do a mission. And our mission, in my case, is to lead the team of 2,000 fine scientists who are responsible to protect and mitigate cyber risk, to protect from cyber threat, and to respond to cyber threat across federal civilian government and the private sector, to include academia.
You're talking about an awful lot of people with an awful lot of jobs. What does that really involve?
Well, in our team, it's anyone from people that can dissect a computer program and understand what it tried to do or is going to do, to the people that can build trust with our stakeholders, companies that might be willing to share information about what they see as cyber threats. And the department takes a very strong role in protecting privacy and civil liberties. So working with lawyers and privacy advocates and trade associations and civil liberties advocates, because ironically, our way of life that we strive so hard to protect could be changed and sacrificed if we don't protect the very privacy and civil liberties that underpin it. So it's an integration of privacy and security. It's a collection of cyber threat indicators, if you will, which are authorities that were given to our operations center by Congress to make sure that we can put data together, preserving the equities of our citizens, fellow agencies, companies, and distributing data out to the different parts of our network to make it smarter so that we can work like your body's immune system and stop bad things or see bad things before they happen. And both private sector and government have huge roles in that. It's symbiotic. My stance on this has always been that government should buy more than we build. We should let the private sector innovate and make money on that innovation, because what happens with that profit is it goes back into more innovation. What we and DHS do uniquely is we can coordinate and put data together and put products together along with unique services to government and put that together and be stronger together.
Is that always symbiotic? Is there ever an adversarial relationship between the two?
Of course there is, because we have different equities. And part of, I think, the beauty of my team is that we work hard to build trust with industry so that when issues come up where each side has a different way of looking at it or a conflicting way of looking at it, we can work through that and do the right thing for our country and our citizens. And I will add, there's an international component to that. Many of our large companies do sales and manufacturing overseas in large numbers. We want to make sure that we make policy and create operations that protect their operations and don't jeopardize the business side, because, again, we're in business to protect our way of life, and that's a large part of it.
Is there ever going to be a time where we can say, oh, we got this now, or is this always going to be a moving target?
It's a lot like biology. It's always a moving target. But we started from a place that I consider far behind, because when the internet was developed, it was never imagined that computers would have such power, so they can compute so fast and create such data so quickly. That's what enables your iPhone to render your pictures so fast. You can just send it out. That's what renders evil software the ability to propagate so quickly. No one ever imagined that the connectivity would create a bad side. So now we're catching up. We have legacy systems we have to figure out how to either replace or protect. That's expensive. But going forward, not only are we concurrently working on protecting what we have, but going forward, really unleashing the power of young minds, diverse minds, student bodies all through the country. Let's build new technology that is as secure as it is hot, and let's change as we go forward to make things so that they are designed to be more resilient. If someone tries to attack you, much like your human body's immune system, you will attack back naturally.
Is a lot of that innovation coming from institutes of learning?
Absolutely. There is a lot of good research happening all over the country. There are many cities all over the country. As you know, DHS has a small office in Silicon Valley that combines our regional presence from a National Protection and Programs Directorate and Infrastructure Protection with someone that is driving operations for that office, with folks from other parts of the department that lead the Silicon Valley effort. We drive cyber operations. We have a regional presence. It's good use of taxpayer money to take our presence in one area of the country and put them together. When people work together, even from parts of a department that's as big as ours, great things happen. And there are so many other cities and areas of our country that would, by their local culture, lend diverse perspectives to this massive mission of Homeland Security and specifically cybersecurity. And working with our university, our academic presence, and our military, the future looks good.
Universities, of course, have cybersecurity programs. What about high schools? What about grade schools? Is it getting down that far?
It is getting down that far in some places. It's all different. It depends on the high school. In some cases, it depends on the teachers. Some grade schools are showing this to younger kids. I think, it's, in my opinion, younger kids have a better mastery of some of the new technologies than some adults. And so it's even more important to show them the issues in keeping themselves safe and their devices safe. And it's really a parental role, as with everything else as well. We have to build this into a culture. It's not just a hoodie in a dark room with a pizza anymore. This has to get as built into our culture as fashion in Hollywood. And make sure, even if we leverage those things, which people embrace and enjoy, if we leverage those things to put a culture of understanding connectivity for the goodness it brings, and the danger it can bring if not used correctly is important, and I believe that's part of our next steps as a culture.
Is teaching young kids cybersecurity going to be the next don't take candy from strangers?
I think it already is. My young nieces are taught that every day by auntie and their mother. But I truly believe that it will be part of the culture. It will be part of the schools because more and more you see school systems using computers as a tool to teach. And what they're doing in many cases is obviously keeping those networks off the internet. But they're also teaching the kids about passwords, and they're also teaching the kids not to click on random links. And often, most importantly, they're teaching the kids when you get a message from someone on a little device, you don't talk to people you don't know. So we're all taught not to talk to strangers. Don't talk to strangers online.
What are the biggest cyber goofs that private people or businesses make?
A personal opinion is putting too much personal information on the internet. Because once something is put out, it can't be taken back. And really having an understanding when you use the internet that you are connected worldwide. And it's your responsibility to protect your device to make sure that somebody that would steal your information is not electronically present on your device or on the device of the entity or person with whom you're communicating. And overall, to treat any new technology as you would treat any new medicine or anything else new in life, with care and with caution, and to understand how things work before you use them.
Does DHS do any work trying to bring people over from the dark side?
Absolutely, and some of my best friends fit that demographic. But we also want to make sure that the department is reaching all demographics, both genders, as I was explaining to a group earlier. The adversary is fairly diverse, and what diversity brings you is different perspectives. You don't even realize it, but when you take people that are different and put them together to solve a problem, your problem gets 1,000 points of light. Your solution is presented better because it has all those different angles incorporated into it. And that's the rock star team I want. And it is hard to go out and try to find all those different people because sometimes they aren't the ones that have the opportunities to come to us. So we are making every effort we can. I think this administration has made gargantuan efforts to bring all different walks of life and certainly make opportunities for women in technology to reach out to younger students and to bless. I mean, our leadership, our secretary, is very much in favor of our finding the best and brightest and top talent from all over the country to come help with our mission. I think it's important to know that cybersecurity is exciting. It's not just a field for the nerds or for the scientists. It's not just a government thing. This is our future, the ability to create and manufacture technology that recognizes malicious activity, that does not need to be secured after the fact. You're on the cutting edge. And in the end, I want people to be able to enjoy new technology. So we talk now about understand what it can do and the dangers it has, the vulnerabilities it has. That's because that technology was not designed with any safety mechanism for cyber. Going forward, I want people to enjoy and embrace new technology and for the vulnerabilities to be the unique part and to have our best brains on the most egregious threats and to remove the noise that we're seeing now and with the right people and the speed of computing, that's exactly what we're doing.
Dr. Phyllis Schneck is Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Still to come, there's a college in southern Georgia that has a fine poet in residence. My chat with him next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Sometimes you just run across a teacher who catches your interest. Jeff Newberry did that to me just by looking at his title. Jeff is a published poet and author from the Gulf Coast who is on the faculty at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Tipton, Georgia, where he is a professor of English and poet in residence. I caught up with Jeff early this year and asked him why an agricultural college has a poet in residence.
It's interesting. All the schools in Georgia have, all the state colleges and colleges have missions given to them by the university system, the board up in Atlanta. And our mission is agriculture, and it's and it always has been. But that doesn't mean that we don't have other schools on campus. We have a school of business. We have a very successful school of business, actually. We have a school of liberal arts, and that's where I'm housed, and we have a degree in writing and communication, and I teach in that degree.
As a published poet, do you get a little more cred from your English students?
In some ways, I do. They'll on campus, you know, every now and again, a student will approach a professor and say, hey, I write. And invariably, it's a very small campus. My name will come up, and they'll come by the office and want to talk, and we'll chat a little bit about the writing world, the poetry world, and, you know, the contemporary world. And also, too, it helps because in class, I'll often say, you know, students are often, particularly non-majors in survey classes, they're shocked that people still write and read and buy poetry. And so I'm able to bring a kind of credibility to the genre when I teach it as well.
Well, one of the things, one of the cliches you always hear is if you're going to write, you should write about what you know. And certainly your poetry has to do with where you lived a great deal of your life, the Gulf Coast.
Absolutely. I was born in 1974 in Panama City, and I grew up in Port St. Joe, close to there. And, you know, it's funny, when I was a kid growing up, when I was a teenager, and I really, you know, I was a musician. I was playing, you know, guitar in a few bands, and I had this idea in my head that I'd become this famous rock star. And the one thing that I wanted more than anything else was to get away from the coast. I had this fantasy of going to California or New York and, you know, do it, making my life there as so many of my heroes had. But, you know, as I began to mature as a writer, I found my imagination, you know, returning there time and time again. And I guess the thing that really got me interested, and it's an interesting story, I was at a party when I was in graduate school at the University of Georgia in Athens, and it was a faculty party, and I was a grad student. I'd been invited, and I felt little uncomfortable out of place, and there was a professor there, and I didn't really know him. He was talking to me, and he said, oh, where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from North Florida. He said, oh, it's pretty down there. And I said, well, there's nothing down there, just little towns. They're all the same. And he said, oh, how can a poet say that? There's beauty everywhere. And that stuck in my craw. And I began to think a lot about the place where I'd grown up, and my imagination just went back there, and that was it was a kind of power that came from my imagination going there.
Well, it's very interesting. You could write a poem called How to Shuck an Oyster. That's that's certainly coming from the Gulf Coast.
Absolutely. A lot of poets write these how-to poems, and that's what I wanted to write, you know, how to, you know, write a letter to the dead or how to, you name it. Sometimes they're portentous and big, and I thought, what do I know how to do? I mean, I can string a guitar, and I couldn't find a lot of metaphor there, and so I began to sketch the poem out, and I realized that really that poem is about shucking oysters, but ultimately it's about communication between two brothers, and they're trying to kind of pry themselves apart so they can talk is really what the poem's ultimately about.
Did writing poems stem from, you know, wanting to write rock and roll songs, and you found it was easier to just do words?
I think so. I went to the University of West Florida to their creative writing, you know, program there, and I got into that program on a novel manuscript. I'd written a really long, unreadable manuscript that I worked on for several years about four guys in a band who did nothing but talk and no plot. And in that program, I took a poetry workshop because it was part of the curriculum, and I really got interested in writing poems. And I discovered a poet named Philip Levine, who died a few years ago, last year, I believe. And he was from Detroit, and he had grown up working, you know, in the grease shops up there, you know, and the factories, and we worked at Chevy Gear and Axle. And I remember thinking, Bob, that when I was young, I thought poetry had to be about, like, gods or goddesses or something removed from me. But when I read Levine's book, What Work Is, which is about just the day-in, day-out, blue-collar life, I thought, yeah, I can do this. This is what I want to explore. This is what I care about.
Talk about some of the subjects that you have written poems about. I mean, we know you shuck oysters. What else is out there?
Fishing. I'm a big fisherman. I love to fish, and there's a lot of metaphor there. there's a poem in the book called Bottom Fishing, you know, which is what you do, you know, when you don't use a cork. You're down on the bottom of the bank, and you're trying to catch what's down there, bottom feeders, catfish, things like this. And that was interesting to me. There's another poem in there called Fishing the Bridge, which is about fishing the old bridge there, a 3-mile bridge across Escambia Bay. You know, so I read a lot about fishing, I read a lot about music and jazz. I'm very interested in jazz. And so I write about that. I know Mark Twain said, write what you know. And I think that advice has hurt a lot of writers because it stunts their imagination. For me, I think that advice means start with where you know and build from there.
Well, let's talk about going from writing poetry to writing a novel, which you've just done. What kind of a mindset you got to get yourself in?
Well, you know, I had always written stories. As I told you a moment ago, I'd gotten into the program on the novel manuscript, and I read a lot of prose for a poet. I loved Southern writing. I loved Harry Cruz, still do. Loved Larry Brown, writers like that. And when I was finishing my dissertation, I was trying to get away from the heady theoretical reading I was doing about jazz poetics, and I picked up a novel by a writer named James Lee Burke, who your listeners probably know well. I'd never heard of him before, and I read his first novel, The Neon Rain, and I was sort of fascinated by the way he joined together the tropes of Southern literature, the interest in landscape, the interest in dialect and people, with the genre of crime, you know, and he kind of put those two together, and I thought, that's really interesting, and I read a lot of his work and others like him, and one afternoon, I was on vacation with my wife in St. Augustine, and I had an afternoon to kill. She was taking a nap, and I hadn't written anything in a while because I'd done with the degree, and I sat down in the afternoon and sketched out the first chapter, and I began to work on it earnestly. After the book of poems came out in 2013, I gave myself totally to the novel. That's all I worked on.
When you're pitching something to a publisher, it's got to be easier to push a novel than a poetry book.
Oh, gosh, yes, man. One of the things I learned publishing a novel is, when I published the poetry community is a wonderful place. There are lots of great people there, and I've made some lifelong friends there. But maybe fortunately, I'm not sure how to say that. Poetry doesn't have a wide audience, and most of the people who read it write it. And we're all very supportive of each other, and we all buy each other's books. When I wrote the novel and got it out there, suddenly I'm getting invitations to be at the Florida Heritage Book Festival. I'm getting invitations to be at the Alabama Book Festival. I'm, you know, being invited to read at universities. And so I think that the novel is still, in many ways, the thing that people turn to when they want to be entertained. And you get readers, you know, when you write a novel in a way that you don't with poetry.
when you are teaching, can you, is it different teaching poetry or teaching prose, or is writing writing?
I like teaching poetry because I really like going word by word, line by line. When I teach prose, I think sometimes I get lost in just the language because I can linger on one paragraph for far too long rather than dealing with a story. I think I'm better with teaching poetry. I'm really, really obsessed with the 1920s and 30s is one of my areas for my dissertation, particularly writers like T.S. Eliot, who is just kind of a touchstone poet of mine, and I can really get lost in what he's doing. But at the same time, students like prose, they like stories, and they like plays, too, and they love a good story, so I like teaching those things as well.
I'm just wondering, being a teacher like that, how much bad poetry have you read?
Probably as much as I've written, which is a lot. Young poets, you know, they're like I was back in the day in the early 90s, man. They feel like they're the first people in the world to ever feel those emotions. You know, when you're young, your emotions are so darn big. Or you feel this belief that you're the only person who ever felt those, and so your poems are often about just self-expression. And, you know, if I can get a poet to the point where he realizes or she realizes that poetry isn't just about self-expression, it's a craft. It's a way of doing something. It's a genre, right? I feel like I've done my job. But at the same time, I don't want to tell them their feelings aren't important, because I think they are, particularly when you're 20 years old, you're 19 years old, your feelings are really important, and I would never tell them they're not. You know, for as many bad poems as maybe I've come across in my time, I've probably written three times as many.
Jeff Newberry is a professor of English and poet in residence at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Tipton, Georgia. His latest novel is called A Stairway to the Sea, and his latest book of poetry is Brackish. They are both published by Pulpwood Press. Do you talk to your pets or other animals? Well, chances are they're talking about you. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do you talk to your pet? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Eric Kirschenbaum, research fellow in the Department of Zoology at the University of Cambridge, delves into whether our pets actually understand what we're saying.
Pretty much every one of us who has a pet talks to their animals. But do they talk back? It certainly can seem like you're having a conversation with your dog, but is he doing any more than just responding to the cues that are associated with food or walkies? It's one of the biggest mysteries in zoology, why we alone in the animal kingdom use language, whereas no other animal seems to come close. But appearances can be misleading. Using mathematical tools, we can look for statistical patterns in animal sounds that, while not being an actual language, show that there's a wider range of complexity than we previously thought. Dolphins, for instance, use specially crafted whistles to refer to each other by name. And recently we've shown that wolves combine different kinds of howls differently depending on where they live. What's more, statistical analysis shows that the way that animals combine sounds isn't just into some random sequence. We don't know what it is or what it means, but it seems that it's not quite as arbitrary as we once thought. Communication should bring huge evolutionary advantages to animals that need to cooperate to survive. And we're only slowly understanding how animals share this kind of vital information. But intelligent social animals like wolves and dolphins seem to have much more communicative capacity than they need for, say, hunting, and it's likely that it's social information that makes up much of what they have to say to each other. Now, these new discoveries don't mean that we're going to find that animals have language after all, but it should help us to understand how simple animal communication could have evolved gradually, but very quickly, into the human language that so distinguishes us from every other species on the planet.
That was Eric Kirschenbaum of the University of Cambridge. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.